Now, after David sinned in the matter of Bathsheba and with respect to Uriah the Hittite, the prophet Nathan, you will remember, came to David, sent by God, and warned David that God would show his displeasure and his disapproval of what David had done. In fact, the words are recorded in 2 Samuel 12 and verse 11. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. And it's now in chapter 13 that we begin to see how God fulfilled that word. The chapter begins with a description of Amnon and the circumstances of the rape of his half-sister, Tamar. And we need to fill ourselves in a little bit as to the background here. Amnon was David's eldest son. Amnon proceeded from one of his wives, a woman known as and called Ahinoam. And you'll find in 1 Samuel 25 and verse 43, the reference to David taking Ahinoam of Jezreel. This was in the days of his exile. But it seems that Amnon was not born until David arrives at Hebron and becomes king there. For in 2 Samuel 3, we read, and verse 2, and unto David were sons born in Hebron, and his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. At the time when this incident took place, Amnon would have been about 20 years of age. And we read that he began to feel an unlawful and a perverse desire for Tamar. Now, Tamar was David's daughter, but by another woman. David's daughter by a woman called Maacah. If you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 3, we read there halfway through the verse, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. So we know that this wife of David, called Maacah, gave birth to Absalom. Now the fact that Tamar is described in chapter 13 as Absalom's sister means that she was a sister to Amnon, but a half-sister. That is, there were two wives of David producing two offspring. One was Amnon, the other was Tamar. Now, since she was Amnon's half-sister, this was what we call an incestuous desire that Amnon had for her. And it was an unlawful desire, because it was expressly forbidden in the law of Moses. In Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 9, we read, the nakedness of thy sister, the daughter of thy father, or the daughter of thy mother, whether she be born at home or born abroad, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover. And then again in verse 11, the nakedness of thy father's wife's daughter, begotten of thy father, she is thy sister, thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. And the reference to uncovering the nakedness, of course, is a euphemism for sexual relations. So this was forbidden. And Amnon doubtless knew that it was forbidden by divine law. Not, I think, that affected him unduly, or restrained him over much, but But what frustrated him most of all was that he couldn't seem to gain physical access to her. Reading these opening words, it seems that the princes had apartments of their own, and the princesses had apartments of their own. And it was very difficult for Amnon to find himself in the company, leave alone alone altogether, with Tamar. But then a friend, so-called, came. Amnon had a friend. He seems to have been a cousin. And his name was Jonadab. And he's described as a very subtle man, verse 3. And the word in the Hebrew means he was a crafty kind of man. And he conceived a plan whereby Amnon could satisfy his desire. It was a very low and mean and unworthy plan. But this basically was it. Amnon was to feign himself sick. And the king, King David, hearing of his son's illness, would naturally be concerned and visit the apartment. When he saw Amnon in his sickness, pale, full of nausea, seeming to be losing strength, he would express concern for him, natural concern, and inquire if there was anything which could be done to relieve him. Whereupon, Amnon would make the request as a sick man that he just longed for some of those cakes which it seems he'd enjoyed in the past, a particular kind of delicacy, which he felt would somewhat revive his spirits. And so he asked King David if he could possibly send Tamar, his daughter, to make these cakes for him to help to his recovery. And David granted the request, not having any reason for suspicion or for believing that there was anything untoward in the request. And Tamar duly came, and she took flour, verse 8, and kneaded it, and made cakes in his sight, and did bake the cakes. Now, she seems to have made this in a kind of adjacent room, in a kind of kitchen. And she took a pan and poured them out before him, but he refused to eat. And in verse 10, Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the meat into the chamber." He was in the bedchamber, next to where the cakes were being prepared, "that I may eat of thine hand." He felt so weak that he could hardly feed himself. This is what he pleaded, you see. And he needed some encouragement to get this food down. And Tamar, who was a woman quite innocent, responded to this need. And when she brought food for him to eat, in verse 11, we read, "He took hold of her." And the force of the Hebrew is he grabbed her. And she protested. She said in verse 12, reminding him very carefully that he was her brother, that this was attempted rape. "Do not force me." That it was a shameful thing to do. "For such ought not to be done in Israel. Do not this folly. And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel." And when all this seemed not to achieve much, and Amnon was intent upon this outrage, she even pleaded, "Now therefore I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee." Now, there's some dispute as to what she meant by that. I think probably she was just playing for time. She did not believe, I think, that King David would actually give Amnon permission to sort of formalize or legalize this incest. But she was referring the matter to the king. But all this to no avail. He would not hearken unto her voice, verse 14, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. So sin was added to sin, inasmuch as the original sin of incest was now compounded with the sin of rape. And that also was a breach of the law of God. If you go back in the book of Deuteronomy and chapter 22, and verse 25, the law reads, "If a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, and the man force her, and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die." Mention of a betrothed damsel in that instance, but that is the leading reference to rape, and it clearly indicates when a woman is forced, it is a capital crime in Israel, for which a man must forfeit his life. Now, as so often happens, as soon as Amnon's desire was gratified, he despised her. And we read that his hatred for her was greater now than the love with which he had loved her before. He not only despised her, but he evicted her and sent her away. "Arise," he says, verse 15, "and begone." He wanted nothing more to do with her. So she became the object of contempt. She was turned out as a kind of abandoned woman. And then to cap it all, Amnon actually suggests that she was to blame for this. "For he called his servant," verse 17, "that ministered unto him and said, put now this woman out from me, and bolt the door after her." Implying that she had had some way intruded into his privacy and taken advantage of him in his own apartment. And in order to save himself any further assault, the door had to be locked. Well, as you can imagine, Tamar was grief-stricken. And she uses three ways of expressing that grief. In verse 19, she put ashes on her head. That was an old Jewish way of expressing great sorrow, as if she'd been reduced to the dust of humiliation. Her life had been burned up and consumed. All hope was gone. She was a desperate woman. She then rent her garment of divers colours, this garment which betokened that she was not only a princess, a king's daughter, but that she was a virgin daughter, pure. She tore it up because her virginity had been sacrificed upon the altar of Amnon's lust. And then she laid her hand on her head and went away crying. The idea there is that she put her hands above her head and clasped them above her head, wringing her hands like this, as if to express her grief as well as her shame. Now, Absalom met with her, and the question in verse 20 is interesting. "Hath Amnon thy brother been with thee?" We'll come back to that in a few moments. He advises her to hold her peace, to bear the outrage patiently, and not to make a great ado about it, because this would produce a public scandal. It may well be that at that point of time, Absalom also believed that the crime would be punished, and that David, as supreme magistrate, would enforce the law. And we know what the law said in the book of Leviticus again, and chapter 20 and verse 17. "If a man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, and see her nakedness, and she see his nakedness, it is a wicked thing. He shall be cut off. He shall bear his iniquity." I say he may have thought that. That's why he advised her not to react, or to continue to react in the way she was, for justice would surely be done. But there was a problem with that. The supreme magistrate, of course, had himself been guilty of adultery. and was in a state of moral paralysis. How could he call his son to account for that which he himself was guilty? Immorality. And so David did nothing. And this leads to the second part of the chapter. For Absalom, although he advised Tamar to hold her peace for a while, to avoid a public scandal, to let justice take its course, when he saw that David had neither the ability nor the will to deal with this offence, he cruelly determined to avenge her himself. And we read that after 2 years, Absalom took revenge. The occasion on which he did so was the sheep shearing occasion, which, going right back to the book of Genesis, was a time of festivity. You'll read of one such in Genesis 38, and there's another in 1 Samuel 25, which won't and need not detain us now. But this was a time of great joy and great gladness, and Absalom devised in his heart that he would somehow get Amnon to this place where the party was being held, and that there he would take vengeance on Amnon, his half-brother. He did it extremely deviously. He invites David and all the king's sons, and David had no great relish for this kind of thing, and excused himself on the grounds that he didn't want to put unnecessary burden upon Absalom to provide for himself and all the king's sons. And Absalom smiled to himself. That was just what he wanted the king to say. And then he said, well, if you can't come, and if everybody else can't come, well, why not let Amnon come? And eventually David allowed Amnon to join him. And it was there, in Baal Hazor, beside Ephraim, after getting Amnon drunk, Absalom called his servants to strike him dead. And they did so, and Amnon was murdered. The concluding part of the chapter tells us how David first heard a garbled account of what happened, that all his sons were dead. There's not one of them left. Verse 30, and we read in verse 31 how the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all of the servants stood by with their garments rent, and so on. And then Jonadab, this devious and malicious character who featured earlier in the story, he comes up and says, no, David, it's not as bad as that. Not all the king's sons are dead, but Amnon only. And he is dead on account of the rape of Tamar. David is still grieved for this, and the more so it seems because Absalom fled and escaped to Talmai at Geshur. Now Talmai was Absalom's grandfather, his mother's father, and he fled there. And David mourned for his son, and we read in the last verse that the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom. Now, one thing strikes me as we look at this history tonight, before we enter the detail of it, that God vindicated his name by a singularly appropriate action. And I mean by that, the judgment which overtook David at this point seemed to answer in a remarkable way to David's own sin. There could be no mistaking the connection between the affliction which overwhelmed him just now and the offence which was the cause of all. And I'll explain what I mean in a moment, just in a moment. But you will observe that God often does that. he judges sin in such a way as to make it clear that the judgment is related to the sin. Now, let me give an example. In the Old Testament, you have Jacob, who you remember with his mother deceived his father Isaac in his old age, in his blindness, and tried to palm himself off as Esau. And the great sin of Jacob was deception. Now that's in Genesis 27. You only have to turn, however, two chapters to find how God catches up with Jacob and deals with Jacob's sin. And how does he deal with it? By causing Jacob to be deceived. And this time by Laban, his uncle. Another example from the book of Kings. Do you remember Jeroboam? Described for us in 1 Kings chapter 13. And he was a wicked king who caused Israel to sin. You set the place of the priest, entered upon holy ground without warrant. And we read how in 1 Kings 13, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of the Lord unto Bethel. And this man cried against the altar in the word of the Lord. And it came to pass, 1 Kings 13:4, when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which had cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put forth his hand from the altar, saying, lay hold on him. And in this case, judgment was immediate. He had laid his hand upon the man of God, and immediately the judgment was unmistakably related to the action, because we read that as he put forth his hand, it dried up so that he could not pull it in again to him. The judgment answered the sin. Now, to return to this particular history here, there had been a twofold sin of which David was guilty. The first was immorality with Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. The first judgment, which came as a result of that, to David and to his house, was immorality. The second of David's sins was murder, in that he engineered the death of Uriah in order to secure Bathsheba. And the second judgment which overtook David in this chapter is murder within his own family. Now, in fact, if you analyze the record even more closely, you will find that a number of further parallels can be drawn. Take, for example, this matter of immorality. David had committed an immoral act with Bathsheba, and the judgment was that immorality broke out in his own family in the form of incest. Now, the parallels between the two are remarkable. In both cases, in the case of the sin and in the case of the judgment, there was an unlawful desire for someone forbidden by the law. David desired what he was not allowed, the wife of another man. Amnon desired what he was not allowed, his half-sister. In both cases, there was some dwelling upon this evil, meditation upon this evil. We read that David was walking on the housetop in the cool of the day, and he looked, and he saw this woman bathing, and he lusted after her, and sin conceived in his heart. In the judgment, we find that for a considerable period of time, Amnon had cherished the forbidden desire for Tamar. In the matter of the sin of David, he called for Bathsheba. In the judgment, Amnon called for Tamar. In David's sin, Bathsheba came to his chamber. In David's judgment, Tamar came into the chamber of Amnon. David was alone when he committed adultery with Bathsheba, and Amnon was alone when he performed rape upon Tamar. In fact, we read how he removed the servants from the bedchamber. And as David's sin eventually came out to his disgrace, so Amnon's sin came out to his perpetual shame. You see how God, in his infinite wisdom and in his knowledge and understanding, ordered the punishment to fit the crime. But then there was this second offence of David's, the offence of murder. And here in this chapter, the judgment concerns the same thing. Absalom takes the life of Amnon. Now, again, the parallels are quite remarkable. In the case of David's sin, he hatched a plot. You recall it, I can't go into the details now. He hatched a plot against Uriah. And it was a very cleverly laid plot. First of all, to bring him back, you remember, from the field, that he might sleep with his wife, so that the child now conceived, actually David's, would be thought to be Uriah's. When Uriah didn't go in, all manner of means were devised to get Uriah to go in to his wife. And then there was an emergency supplement to that plan, that if all else failed, then David would actually arrange for his death in a way on the field. A plot. It was a plot here. Absalom seems to have been 2 years in planning this murder. It was premeditated murder. And it bears all of the marks of a skillfully laid scheme. In the case of David's sin, David called his victim Uriah. He called him from the field of battle to where he was. In the case of the judgment, Absalom did exactly the same thing. He called Amnon to a feast. Now you will remember that in the sin, David showed and pretended great friendliness to Uriah. He wanted him to eat at his table. He inquired about the progress of the battle and the war. In the same way, in the judgment, Absalom pretended the same kind of friendliness and interest in Amnon. Not only saying to his father, well, if you can't come, do let Amnon come, as if he had some special regard for him, but when he came, he entertained him, and he feasted him, just as David did. Now, this is where it becomes, I think, quite remarkable. David, in order to achieve his end, got Uriah drunk. In the judgment which followed, Absalom did the same thing to Amnon. Verse 28, mark ye now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, smite him and kill him. Intoxication used in both cases. One final thing. In David's sin, David did not actually perform the act of murder himself. He arranged for it to be inflicted by others. There in the front line, through his accomplished Joab, Uriah fell. In the judgment, Absalom did not actually kill Amnon himself, but he called others to be involved, saying to them, have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant. And in both instances, friends, great dishonor was brought upon the house of David. It was God vindicating his name. And it was God showing David, be sure your sin will find you out. That though judgment tarry, it does not tarry forever. And when God deals with sin, he deals with it in the most appropriate way and shows that the judgment is not coincidental, but the judgment is designed of God to deal with evil. It shows us, does it not, the absolute justice of God. It shows us, moreover, the power of God, in that the God of the Word, you see, who threatened this, I will raise evil from mine own house, is the God of providence, who is able to fulfill his every threatening. And thirdly, it shows us something of the grace and the mercy of God, for it was to teach David a lesson and to teach all Israel a lesson, which they would never, ever forget, which would be recorded in the oracles of God that sin does not pay. Verily, there is a God in heaven that judgeth sin. Now, if we take the chapter as a whole, and with this background, we needn't tarry over long on the rest of what I have to say. It occurred to me, however, in reading the chapter through several times, that there were three sins highlighted in the chapter. The first is the sin of uncleanness. In the case of Amnon and his passion for Tamar, the sin of uncleanness. And secondly, there is the sin of bitterness, as that sin belongs to Absalom, who for 2 years harbored hatred for his half-brother, and harbored it in such a way that it took control of him and led him to this vile act of revenge, the sin of bitterness. And the third sin is the sin of weakness in David himself. For when Amnon committed the sin of uncleanness, and when Absalom committed the sin of murder, bitterness which led to murder, David did nothing. And in fact, at the end of the chapter, we have David weeping over Amnon and longing for Absalom. Now let's look at these three sins briefly. First of all, the sin of uncleanness. Amnon, of course, was a sinner with a disposition in him to evil, a disposition which gave rise to all kinds of thoughts and desires and longings. Scripture speaks of our fallen nature as flesh, and it speaks of what proceeds from that corrupt nature as the desires of the flesh. And all of us have it. The old Puritans used to describe it as a dunghill in the heart of every man. And as a dunghill will give off odors and smells which are obnoxious, so sin in us is constantly giving rise to yearnings and to cravings which are abhorrent and totally sensual. Now, in the case of God's people, of course, God works a work so that a change is effected. And to counter these natural desires and longings, grace effects a new disposition which has counter longings and counter desires for holiness. Hence the conflict in the soul of the believer between his old nature and is new, between sin and holiness. I find, Paul says, a war within me, a conflict, between the flesh and the spirit. These two were contrary, the one to the other. Now sadly for Amnon, he did not know anything of the power of grace or the principle of holiness, for had he known anything of it, I suspect his language would have been, I must stand still and be in awe and sin not. How can I do this thing, to use Joseph's words, and sin against my God? So there was nothing to check it. There was nothing to match it in Amnon's life. There was just this corruption and the cravings and the desires rising from it, which had absolute sway with Amnon and seemed to carry him as a leaf before a wind. He therefore was given over to this sin. And I think that comes out to that verse to which I'll recall you now, in verse 20. For when Absalom finds Tamar in her distress, his question is this, not who has done this, but hath Amnon thy brother been with thee? Verse 20. What does that tell us? I think it tells us that Amnon was a young man with a fallen human nature, not knowing the grace of God, who lived in an abandoned manner and was notorious for his immorality and his wickedness. And when Absalom saw the evident distress of Tamar and the garments of her virginity torn, he did not have to think twice as to who might have done this thing. Hath Amnon be with thee, he said. The sin of uncleanness. It is a fearful thing. Paul describes it in Colossians 3 in various ways. He's talking about sin and the need to mortify sin. And in Colossians 3:5 he says, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry, for which things sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience. Now the five words used in verse 5 in Colossians chapter 3 all relate to the same sin, the sin of uncleanness. And Paul lists them here as if there were no other sins, as if these were the most grievous and the most heinous of sins, as if these stand out, as it were, in the book of God, as the most culpable of sins. What are they? Fornication, or as we would say, sexual immorality, uncleanness, which suggests something internal, impure fantasizing and imagining, inordinate affection, craving, not just a thought, not just the uncleanness of the heart, but a craving for sexual satisfaction, evil concupiscence, a craving and a yearning which is manifestly wicked, and covetousness, an insatiable desire to have our way and to have our desires fulfilled. For which thing's sake, the wrath of God cometh upon the children of disobedience. You see, it can assume various forms, but when you've described it in all its colours and hues, it remains for Paul the red-lettered sins and sin. It can begin in the heart, as it did in Amnon's case. Out of the heart proceedeth fornication, adultery, and so on. It can evidence itself in the mouth with obscenities and with lewd speech. Let no corrupt communication proceed from your mouth. Filthy jesting and the like, Paul actually refers to. And then, of course, it can actually materialize in an act of life, as in Amnon's case. My friends, it is a terrible sin, and it's one which is abhorrent to God. We read of it in Colossians 3, Paul tells us that that sin of uncleanness, though we live in a world where it is glorified and where it is enthroned, yet Paul tells us that because of that sin, men will be debarred from the kingdom of heaven. They that do such things shall not enter the kingdom of God. I suppose of all sins, it's one of the most dreadful because it is not only abhorrent to God and excludes us from God's presence now and hereafter, but it carries us completely away. It somehow is an obsessive sin. In the book of Hosea chapter 4, we read of this immorality taking away the heart. And that's exactly what it does. Oh, be warned by it. And friends, there is only one remedy for it, and that is a true experience of the grace of God, which leads to true consecration and holiness. We need to yield these hearts of ours with such potential for evil to the Lord. My son, give me thine heart. We need to enthrone Christ there. We need to labor more and more for spiritual things, to try to be spiritually minded, not to look at those things which will incite lust and produce uncleanness, but walk in the Spirit, Paul says, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. In other words, let your life be more and more controlled by the Holy Spirit, and be manifestly under His conduct, so that you don't go to those places where such temptations are strong, and you don't follow those pursuits which make you vulnerable to being overcome, but be under the leadership of the Holy Spirit and go in God's ways, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. And all of the time you do this, watch against sin. Take away mine eyes from beholding vanity, the psalmist says. Psalm 119:33. Turn away mine eyes from beholding vanity. We need constantly to pray that the Lord will not lead us into this sin. For we see what it did to Amnon and what it did to Tamar. It brought shame upon them both. Then there is the sin of bitterness. From verse 21 on to verse 36. In some ways Absalom was as bad as Amnon, for he fell into great sin. But his sin was the sin of bitterness. Old Matthew Henry remarks here, one sin does not cover another. And he quotes from James 2:11, he that said, do not commit adultery, said also, do not kill. It's a strange and an awful thing, isn't it? A terribly solemn thing to think that for two whole years Absalom felt these strong feelings of intense hatred for Amnon. Now, at the beginning, we read that he spake neither good nor evil to Amnon. And the meaning of that seems to be this, that he was indifferent to him. But it was only outward indifference. In his heart, he cherished this bitterness, this vengeful fury against Amnon, which would only find relief when it finds vent in murder. You know, Christians can be guilty of it. In Hebrews 12:15, we read that we are not to cherish any root of bitterness, which springing up could offend many. It's possible to have it, to be offended by someone, to be put out by someone, and to feel strange thoughts towards them so that you avoid them because you can't stand the sight of them and you don't want to converse with them because you have contempt for them, and at the least provocation, all the intensity of emotion will break from your heart and reveal just what you feel to that person. Now, it is quite incongruous in a believer. We have no reason to believe that Absalom was a believer. His sin was terrible, but perhaps it's even more terrible in a believer because Christianity is the religion of peace. Christ is the Prince of Peace. The Gospel is the Gospel of Peace. The Spirit is the Spirit of Peace. The Bible is the Word of Peace. The Church itself is to be the Church of Peace. She's likened to a dove in all her meekness and mildness, inoffensiveness, gentleness. Nothing could be more contrary, therefore, to our holy faith than harbouring this bitterness. Friends, we should not indulge it for a moment, because the effects of it are grievous. They were grievous to Absalom. Don't you tell me that this feeling did him any good for 2 years. It was as if he had a bag of nails in his heart. He could never be happy because he was always thinking evil of Amnon. I suspect that others around him felt the sharpness of Absalom's temper during those 2 years as he gathered together the strongest feelings against Amnon, his half-brother. And at the end, of course, he not only inflicted this cruel act upon Amnon, but he hurt David, his father, and broke his heart and ruined himself. Christians should beware of it, perhaps for even other reasons, that if we harbour that kind of feeling for one another, then there is no future for the Church of Christ. Because a kingdom divided against itself does not stand. Christ told us that. And if there are those supposedly in the fellowship of God's people who have alien feelings towards one another, and unkind, uncharitable thoughts one toward another, the very foundations of the kingdom of peace and of love are fractured and broken. And the church will not survive it, cannot survive it. Furthermore, the world will take advantage of it, because the world is always ready to watch a dogfight, particularly when it's in the arena of the Christian church. Do you remember how Abraham was aware of this? We read in Genesis 13:7 that there was a strife between the herdsmen of Abraham's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. And then we read, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled then in the land. And Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee. What moved Abram to say that? Because the Canaanites and the Perizzites were in the land. And how unbecoming it was for two believers in the same God, Jehovah, two who claimed affinity of spirit and relationship of grace, to be falling out before unbelievers, to be a spectacle to the ungodly, to show the weakness of grace, the power of sin. Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between us, says Abraham. The third reason why it must be avoided at all costs is because it is contrary, utterly contrary to holiness. It's no good us having a sort of high and otherworldly view of holiness, which doesn't relate to our thoughts and feelings for one another. Follow peace and holiness, without which no man shall see God. Hebrews 12:14. These two are related. Well, how do we overcome this bitterness? Since it is so prevalent, since it is so powerful. Well, my dear friends, we need to keep our hearts open to the grace of God, because by pride comes contention, and it's only the grace of humility which will avert that contention. So we need to pray for God to work in us and to work through us. We need to constantly reflect upon what God has done for us. Did he hold bitterness against us? From the moment we were conceived, did God bear resentment such that he would not be reconciled, and that he determined to take vengeance at last upon us? Not so. God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven us. Therefore, says Paul, forgive one another. Gratitude to the pardoning God, the God who passes by iniquity is what will help us to be kind and help us to be good to others. And thirdly, we should take account of the saints of God, those like Stephen, lay not this sin to their charge. And if we would be numbered amongst the true sainthood, then let's see that that is the way of holiness. There is no excuse. Absalom could have said, but he raped Tamar. So he did, and evil was the deed. But it in no way excuses your bitterness towards Amnon. The sin of bitterness, and finally, the sin of weakness. I give this only a second or two. But how sadly David emerges from all this. When King David heard of all these things, verse 21, he was wroth. Is that all? He was wroth. When he heard of the murder which had gone on at the sheep shearing place, the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by with their clothes rent. Verse 31, is that all? He does nothing about Amnon. He does nothing about Absalom. In fact, at the end of the chapter, we read the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom. How do you account for that weakness? Sin had weakened David. Sin is the great weakening influence upon the soul. David had compromised with polygamy and introduced more than one wife into his house. He had had children by them all. And he had added to all this illicit conduct the sin of adultery with Bathsheba. He was now so enfeebled that he couldn't call Amnon or Absalom to account, for he was guilty of both crimes. Friends, it reminds me that the only thing which gives the people of God strength and power is obedience. We are strong and we are courageous, and we persevere in godliness when we keep to the word of God. But oh, learn from David's description here that when we tolerate sin and introduce it to our lives, it is as if our nerves are cut and severed, and as if our muscles no longer function and our spiritual abilities depart from us. And there is no more pathetic state than to see a man of God reduced to this. Three sins to avoid: the sin of uncleanness, the sin of bitterness, and the sin of weakness. May God give us a holy fear to shun all sin and follow after holiness, for his name's sake. Amen.